9:02 on Tuesday, 25 February. Present we have Vice Chair Senator Giesel, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Coghill is excused, and I'm here, Chair Dyson. Hearing three bills today. Senate Bill 106 by Senator Meyer, Senate Bill 133, Senator Olson, and Senate Bill 182 from my office. It is my intention, pending the approval of the committee, to move the first two out of here, and I suspect thunder and lightning from heaven, all having to do with SB 182. But anyways, we will get a presentation on 182, maybe have some public hearing on it, and we'll hold it over to our next business day, which I believe will be Thursday. Senator Meyer, would you join us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, may I?
Sure. Please identify yourself. Oh, and we have the A-team here helping us again today, Chris and Sam. Sorry. Who have ably assisted us before. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the State Affairs Committee. The bill before you this morning is Senate Bill 106, work draft version /N. And it provides for certain individuals to receive a preference right to purchase certain state land without a competitive bid. Oh, Mr. Chairman, I think you'll want to adopt the CS version in. I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee adopt the CS for Senate Bill 106, version 28-LS0864/N before the committee.
Is there objection? Seeing none. The end version is our working document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the purpose of this legislation is to allow state land leaseholders the first opportunity, the first right of refusal on land that they've made investments on and on which they depend for their livelihood. This was brought to our attention by a constituent who has invested a substantial amount of his own personal money, retirement funds, in a hunting lodge on some land that he had leased from the state for a long period of time, and just wanted to be given first opportunity to purchase that land before the land was sold or traded to a municipality. Our current state statutes allow for an individual to receive a preference right to purchase up to 5 acres of land under certain conditions. They must have erected a building on the land. The land must have been used for more than 5 years for bona fide business purpose and under a federal permit or without the need for a permit, and after state selection under a state permit or lease. And Edward, my staff here, will work us through that if there's any questions on that. And then finally, the business the land is used for must have produced at least 25% of an individual's total income for the 5 years preceding the application. So Senate Bill 106 would extend the first right of refusal to individuals who have state leased issued leases. Currently, it only applies to federal. Again, and this is for land that is involved in a municipal entitlement selection. Municipal would also mean borough. The preference to purchase up to 5 acres of land without a competitive bid will be granted under the following conditions. The individual must have erected a building, have used it for a bona fide purpose for 10 or more years, and the individual has received at least 25% of their income for the last 10 years preceding the application for the preference right. The specifics of the program are that in the case of a municipal entitlement selection of the state land, an individual who meets the conditions previously outlined applies for preference right within 120 days of notice of a municipal entitlement selection will be granted a preference right to purchase the land. And the land will be sold at a fair market value, and the SB also 106 also provides a mechanism for which a municipality may be compensated for the land if a leaseholder chooses to purchase it. And then the bill goes through how that works. There is no cost no, there's a zero fiscal note by the DNR. And, Mr. Chairman, in a nutshell, that's kind of a high-level outline of the bill. My staff, with your permission, can certainly go into more detail if the committee wishes.
Questions from the committee? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the overview, Senator Meyer. I was looking at the memorandum that is attached to the bill from Don Bullock, and he asked some questions about whether the acreage will be credited against municipal entitlement, where the money goes, all of those kinds of questions. Could you help us by answering those?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Giesel, with your permission, I'd like to have my staff answer that question. Thank you.
For the record, Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. That, through the chair, Senator Giesel, is one of the reasons why we brought the CS forward today. We previously did not, in our original version, have a mechanism by which the municipalities could be compensated for land that they may choose to, they may have wanted to choose, but then the first right of preference goes to the leaseholder. So in the CS, beginning on lines 26 through 30, it details that the amount of land within the overall municipal entitlement shall be reduced by the amount of land covered under this section, up to the 5 acres that an individual exercise their non-competitive bid rights. And however, subject to appropriation, the revenue from the purchase of the parcel will be given to the municipality if the municipal entitlement land selection is approved. So we felt in this committee substitute that addressed the concerns that the drafter had with the original version.
Thank you.
I want to follow up on that one. So a municipality has applied for and is about to get some land that was state land. A inholder or somebody who has land there in that state property gets a chance to bid at the fair market value on that land. And then that passage you just read says that the amount of land being transferred is reduced by the amount covered under this section. I'm trying to figure out what that means. That land still becomes a part of the new municipality, does it not?
Chair Dyson, that is correct. It would not. Their entire selection would then be reduced by the amount that the leaseholder, if the leaseholder exercises their first right of refusal, then say they have 5 acres and the leaseholder chooses to exercise their non-competitive bid right under this SB 106, then the municipality would receive 5 acres less in that entire area of selection.
Yeah. So, Dyson, to continue, so a municipality is going to have state-owned land as an in-holding within a municipality? Is that correct?
Chair Dyson, that theoretically could be correct. If I might refer to or defer to experts from the Department of Natural Resources on how some of those specifics would work. I believe that Wynn Menifee from DNR is online.
Okay, and we'll come back to them and answer that question. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had some questions. I'm just trying to understand exactly what the bill does, and maybe I can ask DNR.
Sure.
Is DNR ready to go?
Yeah, certainly. Who is available from DNR?
This is Wynn Menifee, Chief of Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water with DNR.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for helping us out. Senator Wilikowski has some questions, as do I. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at page 2 on the bill, and I don't know, maybe it's probably just me, but I'm just trying to understand the bill. So line 9, for instance, says, where there is a valid municipal entitlement selection on state land. Can you explain what that is to me?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. What there is when a municipality has an entitlement, what they do is they select, first step they do is they select the lands that they desire to acquire. Then DNR has to go through a process to consider out of their selections what to provide. They inevitably always over-select for their entitlement because some things might be denied, and they have a certain percentage over they're allowed to select. Their selections are constrained by a certain amount, a certain type of classifications of land, and if they were to select things that are not allowed to be selected, that would not be a valid municipal selection. But if they select things that they're allowed by law to select, then that would be a valid selection. And so that's what the valid municipal selection talks about, is that they haven't been awarded the municipal entitlement yet, but they have selected appropriately.
Thank you. And can you just explain to me what, under what circumstances a municipality would have a right to an entitlement selection on state land?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, a municipal entitlement is when they form a formation of a borough or a municipality. There's a percentage calculation by law that says, depending on the size of the borough or the size of the municipality, that they get a certain quantity of land, and there's actually a calculation that is involved in determining that. And so that acreage is what they can select for.
And then, so I'm from Anchorage. Would Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, do they still have opportunities to get selection on state land?
Senator, through the chair, most of the main municipalities have already received their entitlement, and they have been fulfilled. And so there's only a certain amount of remaining municipalities or boroughs, and in fact some of the new form boroughs that have room to select more. Once a municipality is formed or borough is formed, they have a certain period of time in which to select, and once they pass that date, they can't select anything more. So places like Juneau and Anchorage and Fairbanks, they can't select more municipal entitlement lands. And in fact, I can't say for absolutely sure, but the majority of those have already fulfilled their municipal entitlement.
Okay, so if I could just follow up that. So this, as I'm trying to understand this bill, it appears that it wouldn't apply to land or buildings that are in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau. It's probably more newer forming municipalities. Is that fair to say?
Senator, through the chair, that would be correct. Most of your things like Petersburg, Lake and Peninsula Borough, some of the Northwest Arctic Borough, some of those still have not fulfilled their municipal entitlement. We're just now wrapping up, like the Denali Borough. So some of the more remote ones are the ones that still have entitlements that have to be yet fulfilled.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you, Wynn. Is the term municipality a broad one that includes cities and boroughs?
Chairman, yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I thought so. So if this is Dyson, so if this process was going forward and there was a citizen owned a lease on the state land and that land was being transferred to a municipality, then the citizen who had met the criteria of a building, business, and the 25% would be allowed to, on a bid for that land. Would he get title to the land or just the improvements?
Chairman, this, just to clarify a couple of things that you said there, is that what this allows per line 17 is that after a municipality or borough that has a capability of selecting municipal entitlement lands, you would have somebody that already has a state lease and that has fulfilled those obligations of the 10 years, the 25%, and the building. They have to, within 120 days of notice of the lessee's of the municipal entitlement selection. So what would happen is the state, DNR, would be required, once we get a selection on land where there is a lease, we would notify the lessee that it now has been selected, the state land has been selected by a municipality. And we would provide them 120 days in which to make a decision. If I meet those criteria, do I want to purchase the land? If the way that the bill reads is, if they decide that they do want to purchase it and they meet all those criteria, then DNR shall convey that land with their improvements, are their improvements, but the land to them. And that's minus the subsurface estate, you know, the reservation that the state always does. But the surface estate would be conveyed to them. And just for clarification, I need to correct something that was said earlier by Senator Meyer's staff, is about the preference right and how it affects municipal entitlements. And this is down in the line 26 through 30, just for clarification. On line 27, where it says overall municipal entitlement under 29, whatever, shall be reduced by the amount of land covered under this section. What that's actually meaning is that since a municipal entitlement says you get so many acres, what it means is that when the lessee says, I do want the preference right, I want the land conveyed over to me, at the point it's conveyed over, we decrement the municipal entitlement so as we fulfilled it. It does become part of the borough. It's a taxable parcel. We've given it to the, essentially, wow, it's incorporated in the borough, but they don't get the lease revenues off of it because they're purchasing the land. And the reason why they may have selected it was to get revenues off of the lease. But we're giving them the fair market value purchase price. We provide that to the borough, and they get decremented that amount of their municipal entitlement, so they can't, in addition, select other 5 acres somewhere else. They actually get that as part of the borough.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Thank you. This is a whole new area for me, Mr. Chair. So how many properties do we have any idea would be affected by this law?
Senator, is that to Mylan and Water, or is that to Senator Myers?
If you know, or if Senator Meyer knows, or staff, Senator Meyer shaking his head no. I mean, is this going to have an impact on a lot of properties, or is this just a couple instances?
Senator, through the chair, we anticipate that we might come across some of these, but it is not a large quantity. We did some queries on how many leases we have out in active municipal entitlements, and it's actually a relatively low number, maybe some that would possibly fit this criteria. We have leases out there, but they're more like public and charitable leases and things like that that wouldn't fit this. So of the types of leases that might fit this, maybe there might be in the whole state something like 8 to 12. At the maximum that we see right now. Now, that's just for current leases. There could be other leases in the future that fit this, but as more municipal entitlements are fulfilled, that takes those lands off the plate, so to speak, and so it's only for where you have remaining municipal entitlements.
All right.
And just
Senator Wilkowski.
What would happen now? What's the process now if a municipality selects land and someone has a business on it? I mean, what happens to that property now?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, what happens is that we transfer the valid existing lease to the municipality or borough. And so what happens is that, as an example, it was brought up that this gentleman before that had a lease that got transferred over to the borough. The borough then honors the lease for the term all the way to the end of the lease and starts assuming the revenues from that land at the point of approval of the municipal entitlement. And so they get an annual income off of that lease. It is up to the borough under their own ordinances, laws, and such to determine whether they're going to renew that lease or re-opt the lease or whatever after that term ends. That's completely up to the borough. But if it's a 25-year, let's say somebody has a 25-year lease, and in year 10 it gets conveyed over to the borough, then there's that 15 years left on the lease that the borough will be getting revenues from, and they will manage the lease per the terms that were set out in the lease.
Thank you. I think it's off subject here for this bill, but can you briefly rehearse what it is that happens if the state land gets transferred to a Native corporation and when federal land gets transferred either to a municipality or Native land? What happens with the private leaseholders on those lands?
Senator Dyson, I'm not sure that I can fully answer that because I'm not an expert in the federal laws and their transfers. But if I'm correct, I believe it's a similar in nature that when the federal government transfers, they honor valid existing rights. And so that would be incorporated in that. It's very difficult for a government agency to negate an existing lease because it's a valid contract. It would be a breach of contract to go back on that lease. So they typically will honor that in the transference, and it'll only run as long as it runs. Then it's up to the Native corporation or whoever to determine what to do with it. It's the same thing even when the state gets lands. If the federal, we've received lands from the federal government from the, to the state that have encumbrances of pre-existing authorizations that were done on them, and that does happen at times.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Is there, I'm just trying to think of unintended consequences of a bill like this. Is there any likelihood that if people learn that municipalities may, or new municipalities may be formed or expanded, that people may start leasing state land so that they can be in line for a non-competitive bid?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I will not say it's not possible, but here are the hurdles that I can see with that. Is, let's say a new borough gets formed. The borough has a certain amount of time to make their selections of those lands, during which time, that's not usually a 10-year period, it's something much less. We have 120 days notice after the lessee, after the municipal entitlement land selection, which to give the lessee the opportunity to figure out whether they want to purchase it. They will have, at that time, had to have had 10 years of working that lease, getting their 25% income off of it. So therefore, it seems inconceivable that somebody could go out and, at the point of a borough being formed, get enough underneath their belt to meet the requirements of this preference right. Now, that's not to say that somebody that is operating out there now under lease and a new borough forms around them, that they may very well fit the ticket. So there's definitely potential for existing lessees or even future lessees to somehow fit into this, but it's unlikely that somebody could, at the point of formation of a borough, get enough of the requirements here to meet the threshold to meet the preference right.
Yeah, thank you. Can you stand by for a few minutes?
Yes.
All right, thanks, Wynn. I'm going to take testimony from two citizens who are online. Roger Burgraff in Fairbanks, can you hear us, sir?
Yes, sir.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Okay. I am Roger Burgraff. I reside at 830 Sheep Creek Road, Fairbanks, Alaska. I would like to apologize for not doing a better job in presenting my testimony today. I've not had time to prepare it the way I'd like. Many Alaskans have been caught up of a web of federal ownership versus state ownership. In recent years, the Interior Department, EPA, and the Corps of Engineers have made it very difficult to conduct business on federal lands, a means that has been used by those people that are on federal lands is to try to get those lands in state ownership. The federal government has not honored so-called valid and existing rights. I know many individuals that had property on federal lands, and the government has reneged on protecting them. If the federal government does not want development on state lands, they use the government regulations to prevent businesses and enterprises to develop. I support SB 106 as a means of protecting many individuals and businesses from losing property they have developed through the first preference right. In many cases, individuals' primary livelihoods and assets have been tied up in these properties that they thought they were secure in developing, doing development work on. They thought they were secure in developing these properties and found out later on they weren't. I feel Senate Bill 106 is a means which might help people that had development under federal lands through the process of their becoming state lands, getting ownership or security in the investments that they have. There are many people who were allowed to develop BLM land and were later had restrictions placed on them to make their projects economically impossible and feasible to develop. For a few lucky individuals, they were able to transfer the land from federal ownership to state ownership. So they could better secure their interests. This bill will assist persons to secure ownership of their properties. There are numerous lodges out there, you know, where people have invested. And I know many of the older communities, especially mining communities, where people have property that they've developed, and now BLM is threatening to destroy many old communities.
Can you summarize for us, Roger, please?
Okay, well, I'm just about through. And there are many mining claims used that have been in operation since the early 1900s. So I would like to see, you know, something done which would enable an opportunity for individuals to secure their interests. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions in the committee? All right. Thank you. Now we'll go to Mel Gillis in Anchorage. Can you hear us, Mel?
Yes, sir.
Choke up on the bat there. Get a little closer to the mic, please. We're not hearing you now, Mel. You may have pushed the mute button.
Not hearing you now.
Hold on. Hold on. Yes, sir. Can you hear me now?
Loud and clear.
Loud and clear. Okay, let me try another telephone.
Can you hear me now?
TV or get somebody there. Turn off the TV, would you please? Or the computer.
Yes, sir. I'm here. If you can hear me,
we got you. We hear you.
Yes, sir. I'm here. If you can hear me, we got you. We hear you. Okay, sir. I'm one of the 8 or 10. That Milius was talking about.
Okay, sir. I'm one of the 8 or 10.
We still have the background noise. It sounds like there's a television or a computer that's monitoring this.
Okay, sir. let me try another telephone, please.
No, you're fine on that one.
I'm fine on this one. Okay. Yes, sir. I fall in this category. I have a lodge down on the Alaskan Peninsula, and the land that my lodge was on was given to a borough, and now my lease is up, and what we would like to do, actually, is be able to own some of the land. I have over $1 million investment down there, and a lot of other people in the state have big investments. And the number of people that have these big investments that are being taken over by the boroughs are more than 8 or 10. What's happening, the boroughs are going into DNR and looking and seeing who has what land where. And they look at the pictures and everything of who has what, and they go and pick the best ones. And I've been guiding up here for 43 years, and I'm just about out of business because of the land situation up here. Now, this is a good first step, but people that are doing businesses out in the bush should have a little protection out there.
I think, Mr. Gillis, that you and I probably talked about this here not too long ago. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
Yep. All right. Questions for Mr. Gillis? Question for the sponsor. I suspect when you looked at this that you were tried to look back and see if there was any way to help out people like Mr. Gillis, and came to the conclusion there wasn't. Would you comment?
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, this doesn't help Mel and his current situation, but it'll help future folks. And I think and I appreciate Mel bringing this to our attention. Because it doesn't help his particular situation, but it will help future folks. So that's we feel like. Unfortunately, Mr. Gillis and others are in a tough situation here. They I think in the case of Mr. Gillis, who just testified, he used a lot of his retirement money to invest in this hunting lodge out in the Aleutians, and he just wants the right to protect it.
All right. Any questions or comments from the committee?
Let me just ask one more. Maybe for whoever's online from DNR, what if there's more than 5 acres? What if someone owns a lodge with 20 acres? Then do they just, who gets to pick which 5 acres? Is any thought given to that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this is Wynn Menifee with Money, Land, and Water. And the way it works is it only allows up to 5 acres on line 13, and so therefore there is that limitation. Even if the lease were for, let's say, 20 acres, the bill would limit that to 5 acres. So what the applicant would have to do is they would have to decide out of the lands that they have under lease what is the land that is most valuable for them to have under their ownership. That does not mean that they can't further negotiate with a borough or whatever the future municipal holder, municipality, that they could get other authorizations from them to continue to do business. And as Mr. Gillis had pointed out, sometimes the reasons why municipalities select lands is because they see revenue that could be made off of them. So we have seen it in the past where the municipalities continue leasing land to individuals. It's really up to the business plan of the individual to determine whether having that acreage under their ownership is valuable to them, and if they intend a long-term venture on it, or if they want to sell it or something like that, that's up to them. But they, the surrounding land that wouldn't be in that 5 acres that they might need to do their business, they would have to get that authorized after their initial lease runs out with the borough.
Further questions?
Yeah, and I think what would stop DNR from selling the land right now? Is there, I mean, why, if someone has a hunting lodge, why wouldn't DNR just sell it to them now and as opposed to leasing it?
I mean, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the way that our statutes are set up, that the land that we dispose of is settlement land, and that comes from an area planning process that we go through with the public, and it's a very extensive process to decide where we should sell land in the state, and we have a very active land sale program to do that. What happens is lessees do not necessarily select selected lands. They may select, or they may opt to do their business in an area that's not classified as settlement, and so that might be a wildlife habitat or forest resource or whatever. But the point is we can do a decision to allow them to do the leasing because it wasn't intended to do a disposal, a sale. And so what happens is that under our existing statutes, we wouldn't be able to sell that land to that individual directly unless it was part of one of our land sale programs, competitively offered.
Thank you. Is it fair to assume that DNR is in favor of this legislation?
Through the chair, this the state is, or the administration is in favor of it. It's in the revised version as it stands, that it's very workable.
All right. Any further questions or discussions? I particularly appreciate that what seems to be fair consideration the state's doing in protecting Alaskans and landholders, and would that all that the feds and boroughs would do similar. is there a motion from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate CS for Senate Bill 106, version 28-LS0864/N from this committee with zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, it's moved. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork, and then we'll take up. Record, we will take up Senate Bill 133, that's /A version. Please identify yourself.
For the record, my name is Joy Demmer. I'm a First Alaskans Institute Fellow, and I'm placed in Donnie Olson's office. And today I'll be presenting SB 133, Katie John Day. And so I'll just be brief because we also have people waiting online to testify. but Katie John is an Athabaskan icon to Alaska. She's best known for her determination and success in fighting for subsistence rights. And she's also known for her traditional teachings and way of life. And she lived to be 97 years old. She's passionate about, was passionate about preserving the Athabaskan culture and language, and she also helped to create the alphabet for the Otna dialect. In 2011, she received an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And her husband raised 14 of their own children and then also 6 foster children. And she left behind more than 250 descendants. When considering this bill, one might ask, is it necessary to pass a bill for Katie John's legacy? And my answer would be yes, because by supporting this piece of legislation, we are sending a message to Alaska and to the entire world that we love and support our Alaska Native cultures and the people. So each year on May 31st, all Alaskans can reflect on the cultures and values of Alaska and people's connection with the land, be it native and not native. I want to thank you, Senators, for listening to this bill today that honors the Athabaskan icon of Alaska.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this forward. It's a wonderful bill. Just my only question, the significance of May 31st is, can you talk about how that was selected?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. May 31st is the date that Katie John had passed away. We could not, there's no record of her birth, so we don't know her actual birthday. In talking with folks from the region, Copper River region and AFN, we decided that since May 31st would be an appropriate day.
Thank you.
Brief at ease. On the record. Any other questions or comments in the committee? All right. We have a half a dozen people online who want to testify, and I suspect a few here in the room. I'm quite confident this is going to pass out of committee and will go on, I think, directly to the floor, correct? Yeah, through the Rules Committee. So we want to be respectful and give all of you a chance to testify if you want. But indeed, your testimony is not needed to get this bill out of committee and will take time. But we're very respectful of your interest. And indeed, if I suspect many of you will want to use this an opportunity to praise Katie John and her impact on our state, and so on and so forth. So I'd ask you to use your judgment and on whether or not you want to testify. And if you do choose to, I'm going to ask you to keep your testimony to 2 minutes out of respect for other people that would like to testify and other business we have on our calendar. So of the people who are online to testify, I'll just go right down the line, the ones I have here. Maud Blair in Anchorage.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Okay. I'm Maud Blair. I'm the Vice President of the Alaska Federation of Natives, and thank you for this opportunity to testify today. There are about 120,000 Alaska Native people in the state, and the vast majority of them still participate in hunting, fishing, and gathering food during the year. Subsistence is a way of life for us. It has been the basis of our cultures for thousands of years. As the state's population has grown, we've had to balance the interests of the different user groups with the need to sustain the resources for future generations. Katie John grew up living a traditional lifestyle at Betzel Neddes, a traditional Otna village where her family had a fish camp. The state of Alaska closed the subsistence fishery there shortly after statehood. In 1980, Congress passed ANILCA, which provides for a subsistence priority for hunting and fishing on federal public lands in Alaska by rural residents. It allows state management on federal lands if the state enacts a law that extends the rural priority for subsistence uses to non-federal lands. The state did enact a rural preference on non-federal lands following the passage of ANILCA. However, the State Board of Fisheries denied a request by Katie John and Doris Charles to reopen the fishery at Betzel Neddes. In 1985, Katie John and Doris Charles sued the state of Alaska for not providing us the subsistence priority required under ANILCA. What we call the Katie John cases was actually a series of different lawsuits that involved several plaintiffs and have wound through the state and federal court systems. Katie John was the lead plaintiff and very much a leader in the push to preserve the subsistence rights that we Native people have enjoyed for thousands of years. The Alaska Supreme Court ruled in 1989 in another case that the rural residency preference the state had adopted to comply with ANILCA and manage federal lands had violated the state's constitution. So the federal government took over management of the federal priority on federal lands but refused to extend the authority over any fisheries. Katie John and Doris Charles then sued the United States in federal court to protect their fishing rights under ANILCA. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals held in 1995 and again in 2001 that the federal priority for rural users applied to Betzel Neddes and all other areas where the United States holds reserved water rights. This was good news because it meant that Katie John and other rural residents have a priority for subsistence fishing on federal lands, which make up about 60% of the state.
Maud, you're just about out of time. Can you summarize, please?
Sure. As was mentioned already, Katie John didn't get to hear the most recent part of the case. It's still going on. It's been going on for 29 years. She passed away on May 31. May 31 is also significant because it's the day the state of Alaska allows Native people to put their fish wheels in the water. Each year at our AFN conventions, we pass resolutions of importance to us, and the very first one we passed last October was asking the state of Alaska to name May 31 Katie John Day, and we would so urge you to pass Senate Bill 133 into law and establish it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Maud? All right, we'll go to Suzette King in Juneau. All right.
Hello,
Suzette. Yeah, please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Senate Chair. My name is Suzette King. I'm representing the Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 70. Our mission is to better the lives of Native people and their families, to fight for civil rights and the rights of all Alaska Native people, to share the cultural knowledge, wisdom, and artistic beauty of Native tribal society, and to strive for the spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood among all people. Our ancestors fought for the betterment of Alaska Natives, just as our Athabascan sister, Katie John. Katie John belonged to the Athabascan Nation. She was important in the heat of subsistence fight, and for like many in her time, it was a fight for our way of life. She worked for Alaska Natives because it was the right thing to do. Written records shown 2001, her fight for the fight took her to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling stating that subsistence fishery protection provided under Title VIII of Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA, did in fact to this, to all navigable waters in which the federal government owned reserved water rights, effectively allowing subsistence fishing to continue unrestricted in those areas. The Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 70 stand with our brothers and sisters from the northern part of the state of Alaska in honoring Katie John. The subsistence fight she fought not only benefited the northern, but us in the southeast panhandle. We support Senate Bill 133 to establish Katie John Day each year on May 31st. Katie John was an Alaska Native woman we all strive to live like. She was a member.
Suzette, can you summarize? You're out of time.
Okay. Katie John was celebrated and honored in the Alaska Native, Alaska Federation of Natives in 2003. We celebrate her by a gathering of many, and we Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 70 encouraged to enact Senate Bill 133 and honor Dr. Katie John.
Thank you. Any questions? I'd like to repeat for all of you, this bill will pass out of this committee today if we get through the testimony. And the testimony is not needed to get the bill out of committee. And also encourage you, to, if possible, to not repeat what was said by the people that testified ahead of you. We'll go now to Catherine Martin in Glen Allen.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Dyson and committee members, for the opportunity to testify on SB 133. I also want to thank Senator Olson and Senator Ellis for introducing the bill for consideration. My name is Catherine Martin. I am the Senior Vice President of Aetna Incorporated, and I am a granddaughter of Katie John. On behalf of the Aetna people and the family of Katie John, I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify regarding the establishment of Katie John Day, May 31st. My grandmother, Katie John, needs no introduction. She is a hero to the Aetna region. If you are an Alaska resident and familiar with the subsistence history since 1984, then you know Katie John's story and her public contributions while she was living. After a long life dedicated to others and the protection of Alaska Native subsistence rights, Grandmother Katie went to be with the Lord on May 31st, 2013. She was 97 years old. Some would say it was no small coincidence that Grandma left us on this particular day. If you are from the Aetna region or familiar with state subsistence fishing regulations, then you know the Aetna people turned their fish wheels on at midnight on May 31st, which starts the beginning of our fishing season. Grandma left us as she lived with us, with a sparkle in her eye, love for her family and people, and a sweet, serene smile. While our hearts grieve for her, we also celebrated the incredible woman she was. Close to 1,000 people attended Grandma's funeral and potlatch in Mentasta on June 7, 2013. Aetna Incorporated and the delegates of the 2013 Alaska Federation of Natives Convention passed resolutions calling for the state of Alaska to designate May 31st Katie John Day. While she is my beloved grandmother, my family shared her with the people of Alaska. The following is what the history books say about Grandma Katie. Katie John is an Aetna Athabaskan Indian and the daughter of the last chief of Bensonitas. She was born in 1915 near the present-day community of Salina.
Can you summarize, Catherine? You're out of time.
Okay, I'll just move to the end then. My grandmother was an amazing Alaskan. She is a symbol of Alaska Native subsistence rights. It is an honor to speak regarding her legacy. Later this week, I'll be attending a ceremony in which Katie John will be inducted to the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame. Our family is touched with the statewide support, recognition, and love for Katie John. Naming May 31st as Katie John Day would be an incredible honor and show of respect for a woman who lived her whole life taking care of others. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in favor of SB 133. It's an end.
Thank you. You chose wisely in choosing her for a grandmother. We'll go now to Fred John, son of Katie in Delta Junction. Can you hear us, Fred?
Can you hear me?
Got you loud and clear.
Okay. My name is Fred John, Jr. I'm the son of Katie John. I just want to say thank you for giving me time to speak on Senate Bill 133. Our family support us. I'm talking for Katie John's family right now. I just want to say that my mother, Katie John, taught us to never brag about the animals we take or hang antlers on the wall. She taught us to care for what the land gives, and we would share it. That is our way. These are the few reasons my mother Katie fought so hard for her children, her village, her people in the state of Alaska. She fought for who we are as a people. She fought to make us proud for who we are. Even after we were taken away to boarding school and beaten for speaking our language, even after all that, she never became bitter. She still taught us to continue to give and cheer from our heart and not just take. We knew if love is not in this, it will not work. She loved our state and our people. She told us to tell our story, that our ways are not a threat to the state of Alaska and to our way of life is good for our for Alaska. I just want to thank you for that little thing. I just want to tell you the heart of Katie John, and I thank you for just listening to me.
Oh, thank you for your testimony. We are honored to move this forward. Well, any questions for Fred? All right, go to Haven Harris in Anchorage. Can you hear us?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
My name is Haven Harris. I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I just wanted to call in support of this bill. I had the pleasure of meeting Katie really briefly. I'm dating one of her granddaughters, and her contribution to all of Alaska is something that should be shared in our history books, and I know it would be a tremendous honor for her to be recognized every year on the day of her passing and in recognition of the time. That's all I have. Thank you.
And thank you. Is there questions for Haven? We'll go to Julie Roberts in Tanana. Roberts Hislop. Can you hear us, Julie?
Yes, good morning. My name is Julie Roberts Hislop. I'm currently the Vice President for Tanana Chiefs Conference. And I support the passing of Senate Bill 133, recognizing a special day for Katie John. She was an amazing person that lived a lifestyle that many people today will not ever have a chance to see or experience. When contact was first made with the Alaska Native people of Alaska, the Alaska Native people opened their homes and shared their knowledge and their skills of survival in our great land. They saved many lives of the great explorers, and it is only right that the state of Alaska make a day to honor one of the greatest inspirations of our lifetime, Katie John. During her lifetime, she taught many individuals the importance of what it is to be able to feed their family and to teach the traditions that was passed down from her ancestors. The state of Alaska has an opportunity to honor and acknowledge a woman of strength and courage, a woman that fought hard for a way of life that cannot be forgotten. And I'd just like to say it's an honor to be able to testify today to support the passing of Senate Bill 133. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Other questions? Seeing no questions, I have Liz Medicine Crow in Anchorage. You're marked on my list here as just available to answer questions. Did you want to testify, Liz?
Hi. No, that's okay. I think everyone's done a really amazing job so far. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. is there anyone here in the room that wants to testify on SB 133? Seeing none, I will close the public testimony. What's any questions or comments from the committee? Chair, I'll entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill number 133, version 28 LS1288/A from this committee with zero fiscal note and attached individual recommendations.
Any objection? Seeing none, SB 133 passes. We'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record, we'll now take up SB 182. That is the N version. Is that correct, Joshua?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, we'll take up the SB Bill 182 as our order of business. This originates from our office. We were asked to consider it by the administration. As I understand it, 1977 law established a protocol for cost of living adjustments or differentials, commonly known as COLD, for employees of the Marine, working on the Marine Highway vessels. And at that time, compared the cost of living to Seattle. And as I understand it, at this time, all the other municipal or state employee groups have a cost of living that's consistent across, and I believe it is based on Anchorage, and that the data shows Anchorage and Seattle cost of living are virtually equal. So this bill, if it passes, will put the Marine Highway employees on the same system of cost of living differentials as all the rest of the state employees. Current bargaining agreements will not be changed, and this will only be enforced if it passes for the agreements that have come up in the past. And I understand that there's a significant, could be a significant savings to the state, and in these tight budget times, that's saving money on expenses is attractive. My chief staff, committee staff person, Joshua Banks, will explain the bill sectional analysis. Joshua.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joshua Banks, staff to Senator Dyson. And this morning I'm going to do a brief sectional of Senate Bill 182. Start with Section 1, adds a subsection in AS 2340075, which is the section that for items that are not subject to bargaining between the state and public unions for collective bargaining agreements. This section will prohibit parties from adjusting the salary of in-state employees based on the difference of the cost of living in Alaska and outside of Alaska. The purpose of this section is to ensure that to ensure the legislative intent of of taking out the cost of living differential, and it will not eliminate other options that the state has and the public unions have to promote living in the state of Alaska. We are most certainly in favor of providing incentives for state employees to live inside the state. Section 2 will repeal AS 2340210 and reenact it to without the statutory requirement to provide the cost of living differential for employees living outside the state based on the cost of living differential between Alaska and Seattle. The cost of living differential is not necessarily a problematic portion of this statute. It is the fact that we have to go back to the cost of living differential from 1977 that we felt we ought to change the statute. We want to ensure that the benefits for public employees reflect current cost of living, and that this statute, as it stands, limits the ability to do so. This section also deletes language used to determine how an employee will be eligible for the cost of living differential. And the language that is reenacted is already currently in law, so we're not adding anything to this section. Section 3 ensures that Senate Bill 182 will only affect bargaining agreements settled after the effect, on or after the effective date. So agreements that are passed before the effective date will still include the cost of living differential for state employees. And then Section 4 establishes an immediate effective date.
Are there questions for Joshua? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I don't know, Josh, if you can answer these or maybe the administration, but do you know which bargaining units this would apply to?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, primarily the three maritime unions, since the I believe in your packet it shows a percentage of who of the unions that live outside of the state.
So if I can miss you. So no, wouldn't apply to those bargaining units within the state that have a geo differential, like public safety employees, for instance?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, from my understanding, and the administration officials could correct me if I'm wrong, but the cost of living differentials throughout the state, so troopers living in Bethel or Nome, they'll be able to receive an adjusted pay to compensate for the high cost of living. So this won't affect those employees.
Mr. Chair, another question. So I'm just trying to understand the fiscal note, and it's kind of an odd collective bargaining agreement, but as I read the collective bargaining agreement that we have in our packet, which is the International Organization of Masters, Mates, and Pilots, it looks to me like they set a base salary rate, and then you get a cost of living adjustment if you live in Alaska. Is that how the agreement actually works?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is either depending on which of the unions, it's either an hourly rate change or it's a lump sum on top of the monthly salary.
And if I could just follow, Mr. Chair. So as I understand this, there's a $7 million fiscal note, $7 plus million fiscal note, 7.6. The entire impact, what the result would be is it would keep the rates for those that live outside the same, and it would drag down the Alaskan salaries. Is that how this works?
Senator Wilkowski, I suspect that would be better answered by people in the administration, and we have passionate people here to testify from representing these unions and the staff and so on. Did you have a question?
That's fine, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right, somebody here from the administration? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nikki Neal. I'm the Director of Personnel and Labor Relations.
I'm Kate Sheehan, Deputy Director of Labor Relations.
All right. Please give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that it's the interest of the committee to receive some background on the cost of living differential.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, then we'll proceed. AS 2340-210 requires that collective bargaining agreements include a pay plan that's designed to provide a cost of living differential between employees residing in the state and employees residing outside the state. In 1977, that statutory authority was amended, and the amendments were targeted at the Marine units. The salaries paid to employees residing outside the state were to remain unchanged until the difference between those salaries and the salaries paid to employees residing in the state reflects the difference between the cost of living in Alaska and Seattle, Washington. Essentially, in 1977, the cost of living in Alaska was much higher than Seattle. Subsequently, and I'll refer to it as COLD, the cost of living differential, was negotiated into collective bargaining agreements. It provides a differential to those living in Alaska. Currently, the cost of living differential for the masters, mates, and pilots and for the marine engineers range between $453.80 to $664.40 per pay period. They have 26 pay periods in a year. Those rates last changed in 2007. The Inland Boatmen's Union, it's actually added to their hourly rate. So they currently receive approximately between $4.06 per hour and $5.04 per hour for the cold.
Excuse me. Do they work something like the 2,000 hours a year that most...
They do. They work slightly more than 2,000. I believe it's 2,184 per year.
All right. Sounds like a pretty precise number. All right. Thank you.
In 2008, with funding approved by you all, the Division of Personnel conducted a geographic study, differential study, and that was done by the McDowell Group. That study indicates that the cost of living in Seattle and Anchorage are about equal. Are there any questions?
Well, and as I remember, all of the cost of living or regional cost of living things that the state does are based on Anchorage as zero, and any other sites are plus or minus that?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We consider Anchorage as base.
All right. I went to public school, but I'm pretty good at math. Those are pretty significant numbers. The masters and mates work something like the 2184 hours?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. All right. Thank you. In speaking with some delightful, enthusiastic members of these unions the other day, they eloquently made the case that part of what working for the Alaska Marine Highway System, part of the attractiveness is that salary and benefits is satisfactory and enables them to attract and keep qualified people. And that with the competition for mariners, licensed mariners, around our continent, there's a great demand, and that recruiting and retention will be an issue. Would whoever is appropriate speak to that and how the administration will respond?
I'm wondering if that's a question that's better directed for to the Department of Transportation. And we do have someone here.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. Who's here? Yeah, please. Can you join us? And one of you, at least, set aside here for a minute. And I suspect that many of the questions will be a better answer to somebody at DOT. Please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. For the record, my name is Ruben Yost. I'm a deputy commissioner of the Department of Transportation, and I oversee the Alaska Marine Highway System.
Just the man we need.
So the question, as I understand it, is how would we address the situation of recruitment and retention if this bill were to go in effect as it is now? The way we view this is that we would negotiate base pays, taking into account what the drop in pay was for Alaskans who it was, quite frankly, part of their compensation that they would not now be receiving. But we do a lot of recruiting for all three of the maritime unions, but most particularly for masters, mates, and pilots, and for the Marine, for MEBA, from outside the state of Alaska. And we have very good people who choose to work from Seattle or points even further south based on that salary. You mentioned geographic differentials. Except for the crews that work on the three-day boats, the Fairweather, the Chiniga, and the Lituya, you're not required when you work on a vessel to live in any particular community. So right now we have a cold, which is paid regardless of whether you live near a change port. You could live in Fairbanks and receive it and be further away from your change port than if you live in Seattle and your change port is Ketchikan. So each person who works on a vessel that is crewed either week on, week off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, or in one case, 4 weeks on, 4 weeks off, decides where they want to live based upon how much it costs them to get to work, where they want to live, et cetera. So for our day boats, we think it would be appropriate to look at a COLA, a cost of living allowance, based upon that community, because for those boats, you have to live in that community for the week or 2 weeks on that you are on the vessel, because there is no accommodations on the vessel, so you will spend each night in that community. So,
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it fair to say that if this bill passes, the practical impact is that those people who live in Seattle or in the lower 48, their pay will remain the same, and the residents of Alaska who work for the Marine Highway System will receive a pay cut?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is correct, assuming that nothing changed during negotiations. And we are already considering during negotiations that if the cold were to go away, how that money could be applied to the base rate of pay. So I don't think anyone from the unions would tell you that they would just accept this as is, that they wouldn't want to negotiate to take some of that savings and apply it to the base rate of pay. That'll be something that would have to be addressed.
And I mean, I'm just thinking this out going forward. It's an old language in the contract. It's very old, decades old, and it's kind of unusual language. But if you go back to the table and you don't have a provision like this in there, then the likely outcome is probably you're going to end up raising the rates of the people in Seattle or Washington and keeping the people in Alaska either flat or low. Is that probably a fair outcome?
It's hard for me, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, it's hard for me to predict what the outcome of negotiations would be, but that is a possibility. Keep in mind that right now a person can live wherever they choose to live, and they may be living in an area that has a lower cost of living than Anchorage, but they're receiving this differential that was originally put in place because there was a significantly higher cost to live in Alaska. So,
maybe I got confused. The people that live in Seattle, there will stay the same.
Through the chair, based on this legislation, that pay would stay the same.
Okay.
My point was that in negotiations, that isn't going to be ignored, and there will be an effort to raise the base salary for everyone. Not. It couldn't be particularly just for the people who live outside the state.
Now my understanding, perhaps flawed, was if this passes and the cold goes away, then for these people, the COLA would be applied, just like all other state employees. Is that right?
I believe you could answer that better than I could. But I would just mention before I pass it on to the director that we only have three boats where people have to live in a given community. Otherwise, they arrive at their change port, and then they're on the boat for 2 weeks. They get off at their change port, and then they go to wherever they live, traveling on their own means of transportation. So,
but let me understand what you just said. But wherever they live, if it's in Alaska, they get COLA, like every other state employee.
I don't believe that's true, but I would defer to Department Administration.
Ah, okay. I'm glad that got clarified. Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, for the geographic differential that applies to other state employees,
yes,
to apply to the three Marine units, that would need to be negotiated with them through collective bargaining. That's certainly an option. As Deputy Commissioner Yost said, it'd be relatively easy to apply to those three day boats because employees that work on those boats typically reside in those locations. It will be more difficult to come up with a solution for the remainder of the employees because they live all over the state. It's not based on their duty station or change port. But yes, negotiating something is certainly an option.
So do all of the other state bargaining units all have the same COLA in their agreements?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. With very few exceptions, we've not yet obtained an agreement with the new rates with the Labor, Trades, and Crafts unit, but the others do include it.
All right. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair. If you look at the contract, the collective bargaining agreement 1701, it's old language, but what it does is it sets a base rate for Seattle, and then it says everyone that lives in Alaska gets a higher rate. If we remove the cost of living differential, everyone drops down to Seattle rate. And they're saying, well, if we, you know, we'll go back to the bargaining table and try to negotiate that up. Well, what will happen is the Alaska workers will probably get less than they used to get. The Seattle workers will get more. This bill will increase the wages of Seattle workers, decrease the wages of Alaska workers. I think there's no other impact that can come of this.
Respond? Ruben, that might be yours.
That was a statement, not a question, but I think that you're correct, that'll be the effect. I think from the department's and the administration standpoint is that we have this inequity that if are we going to keep it in place forever, or are we going to do something that addresses it? And I would like to add one thing if I could. The problem that Director Neal was referring to is that if you were to apply the geographic differential that's currently in other contracts, where people are required to work in that community, you could run into the situation where a person who's changed port is Ketchikan, but who chooses to live in the most expensive part of the state would receive that differential. Whereas you, for vessels that you have to live in the community where you get off the boat every day, it's clear that at least for half the year, for 2 weeks out of every four or 1 week out of every two, you're going to live in that community because you need a place to stay. But if you're 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and you choose to live in a very expensive place in the state, I don't know how we would justify compensating a person who chose to live there rather than was forced to work there, live there because of their work.
All right. Senator Wilkins.
One last question. Does the Parnell...
Excuse me. For the record, Senator Coghill just joined us.
Thank you. Does the Parnell administration support this bill?
I believe so, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Any other comments, questions?
I'd
sir,
like to add
Ruben?
One thing, Chairman. Not only does the current cold give a vessel employee a tremendous incentive to live in the state of Alaska, it also gives them a tremendous incentive to attempt to collect it if they don't. And one of the things that removing this and coming up with some other level form of compensation would mean that the department would not be involved in investigating reports of people who are claiming to live in state who don't. And we have quite a few of those cases. Most of them go to end up going to arbitration, and usually the department prevails. But we would like to not be in the position of having to investigate where people have their primary residence. So, thank you.
All right. I suspect we're going to have quite a bit of public testimony and lots of questions from the committee. So what we're going to do now is we will adjourn. Do we have this scheduled for on Thursday to continue?
Is Bill's speech to be heard?
All right. We will go off the record. Then take public testimony on this bill on Thursday. And glad to have you all here, and we will endeavor to hear from all of you. I will ask you when you're there to not necessarily repeat everything that the fellows and folks ahead of you. I'm hard in hearing, but three or four times, and I generally get it. And we'll look forward to that discussion. We're adjourned.